On this episode of Skeptico, Dr. Roger Nelson of Princeton discusses the Global Consciousness Project's findings during the events of 9/11.
It was from, I think, 10 or maybe 20 minutes before the first plane hit and continued for 4 hours after the first plane hit. And that shows a significant departure from expectation in the measure that was specified formally. Because it was a big event, we naturally feel it's sensible to look at the data and find out what the data look like. And then that turns out to be striking in a number of ways.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and this episode of Skeptico is part two of my examination of the Global Consciousness Project. You'll recall on part one, we had an interview with skeptic Brian Dunning, host of Skeptoid, and we spent a good deal of the time talking about the Global Consciousness Project. And it stirred up quite a debate between us about Brian's skeptical analysis of that work. So after that interview, I was really wanting to drill into this because I really thought that Brian had just made some really obvious mistakes in his analysis. So I emailed Dean Radin, and he was nice enough to get back to me with this response. I'm going to read to you that email. I recently completed an interview with Brian Dunning of Skeptoid. We discussed the Global Consciousness Project and Brian's criticisms. Even with my limited understanding of this research, it seems obvious he's made some errors in his analysis. And then I provided him a list of Brian's criticisms of the Global Consciousness Project, and I pulled that right off of the Skeptoid transcript from this episode, so I didn't edit anything into what Brian had to say there. Here's Dean's response. He says, I'm copying this to Roger, Dr. Roger Nelson at Princeton, and he introduces me by way of this email. And he said he's the prime mover behind the Global Consciousness Project. Then he goes on to say, my quick responses, which Roger can amplify on, as could anyone if they bothered to study the Global Consciousness Project website. And then he's going to give those responses, and I'm going to go into those in a minute. But I have to say that I really dug into the Global Consciousness Project, and he's completely correct. Everything is right there, very, very concrete, spelled out quite succinctly. But here were some of Dr. Radin's specific responses to Brian Dunning's criticism. The first criticism was that the Global Consciousness Project doesn't define what qualifies as significant, what event qualifies as significant. And Dr. Radin actually sent me a paper that he wrote, and I published this on the Skeptico site, and you can find a link to it. He goes through in detail the criteria that they use. Again, as we talked about, some of the events that they pick are actually scheduled in advance. Some of them are picked retrospectively, but even the ones that are picked retrospectively, they have a clearly defined way that they define what those events are. Second criticism, they don't define what type of effect in the data constitutes a result. Dr. Radin's response is that the statistical outcomes are very precisely defined, and you'll hear more about that later, but that's exactly the case. They are completely, in very standard, well-understood terms, defined beforehand. Okay, going on to some of those other criticisms, the analysis is not blinded in any way. When something happens, they look at their data and then find patterns. This is Brian Dunning's criticism. And Dr. Radin's response, all the data are freely available for anyone to blindly reanalyze. Think about that for a minute. So the criticism is, hey, they don't blind themselves to the analysis beforehand. And his response is, the data's there, 10 years worth of data. Go back and reanalyze it anyway and show us where the problem is. Dr. Radin goes on to say, no skeptic has attempted to do this, to my knowledge. In any case, several of us have independently reanalyzed certain events like 9/11, and we get the exact same result. Next, they don't look for alternative causes in the data anomalies, sunspots, cell phones, etc. Dr. Radin's response, false. Much effort is going into looking for alternative causes, including solar and geophysical. Also, the random number generators are specifically designed to be impervious to mundane influences like electromagnetic signals and fields. Next criticism. They make claims of specific numbers for how they beat chance. Clearly, it's impossible to have meaningful metrics given the lack of standards for scoring and choosing events. Dr. Radin's response. Not just false, stupid. Chance expectations are clearly defined and the actual data are significant far beyond chance. Again, he's being very blunt there, but there's really no way around it when you look at the data. And then finally, they make no attempts to falsify their theory. This is really just a repeat of the point made earlier, and he points out that he's already addressed that. So with this in mind, I dug into the Global Consciousness Project website, read a lot, read their very excellent frequently asked questions, and at that point, I was really incensed. It was just another example to me of how skeptical analysis, critical thinking on their part, falls way, way short of their purported goals. So I was able to schedule an interview with Dr. Roger Nelson from Princeton University, and we had a chance to talk more about the Global Consciousness Project and some of the criticism that it's received and some of the ways that he's dealt with that and really controlled for that inside of his experiment. Here's that interview. It kind of galls me that you have to even respond to some of this criticism. I think it's inappropriate for you and folks like Dr. Radin to continuously have to engage these skeptics. Yet they have a lot of sway. They get a lot of media attention. I really do feel like it's beneath you, but I feel like it's not beneath me. So I like to get in there and say, hey, where's the critical thinking that you always talk about?
Yeah, really?
Why aren't you applying it to your own analysis?
Right. I totally agree with you. And on the other hand, some of us, and maybe Dean and I are both pretty good examples, respond to intelligent and informed skeptics, but I'll speak for myself, pretty much ignore the completely, I don't know where they come from. People who imagine they know things, but absolutely know nothing about what's being done or what it might mean or how statistics works or anything else that you have to know in order to understand this kind of work. We're right at the edge of what we know about, and we understand that means we have to be especially careful. Otherwise, we make mistakes that make it look like something's there when there isn't anything. And so we're very much educated by the quality skeptics, people who pay attention and try to understand what's happening and say, did you think of this? You know, that's another kind of matter altogether. We're hugely grateful to people like that who will take the time, learn what's going on, and then if there's still questions, ask them.
You know, I just have to interject, as I've been at this little Skeptico thing, which just kind of started as my own project to kind of understand whether the skeptical side of the argument really did have any merit. And I have to say, over the last 2 years, I've come more and more to the opinion that that open-minded skeptic that you're talking about doesn't really exist. I mean, there maybe so. There are so few and far between. But the folks who are even put forth as being the most scholarly, you know, the most academically well-credentialed, you know, Richard Wiseman, Michael Shermer. I mean, these people are making huge, obvious, logical errors. And when you point them out, they just refuse to acknowledge it. And I look at the criticism that you've received from the Global Consciousness Project, and buried in there are some little tidbits of perhaps valid criticism, but they're always wound up in this ball of nonsense and clearly inappropriate sideshow debates that it's really hard for me. I don't see it. I don't see the honest skeptic who's really saying, gee, let's figure this out. Let's sit down arm in arm and really figure out what's going on here. I don't know. Do you really encounter those folks?
Well, you're really quite right. In my experience, they're rare. But yes, I have encountered a few, mostly years ago, but rather recently, and a guy named Jeff Scargill, who I think may be blocked from ever believing this is real, but at least what he does is look at the situation and say, well, for example, he says, you're using an exclusive OR to remove bias from your data. And he says, that means you are removing any possibility of affecting your data. He says, you're throwing out the baby with the bathwater and so forth in that vein. The problem is that the data that we collect actually show changes in spite of throwing out the baby with the bathwater. So that means that his background of assumption is wrong. But still, he's asking a serious and question, which results in us stirring the pot a little deeper, trying to find out, well, if his idea has merit at all. I mean, if he's even half right, then maybe we are throwing half the baby out with the bathwater. And let's see what would happen if we try to understand how something could possibly get through the XOR.
Let's take that example. No, let's take that example, because I read Scargill's paper. And, you know, one thing that I pointed out to Brian Dunning, who I had this conversation with, who is a skeptic and publishes a very popular skeptical blog and podcast called Skeptoid. In part of the dialogue, he had referenced Scargill's paper, so I went and looked at Scargill's paper. You know, first thing I need to kind of reemphasize is that Scargill's paper is published right alongside your paper and Radin's paper in the Journal of Scientific Exploration. So sometimes when skeptics call out this paper as some kind of criticism, it seems to me like a pretty fair scientific debate. You know, everyone's talking to each other, everyone's publishing in the same journal, and everyone's trying to figure out the truth, let's say.
Yeah.
So that's point number one. But point number two, I read Scargill's paper, and I have to say personally, I think you're being a little bit too generous. I mean, he seems to be nipping at your heels on some minor stuff. The XOR stuff is really interesting, but you know, the logic that he applies to why this is such a huge oversight is kind of strange too. It says, "Oh, you guys claim that there's this consciousness effect. Aren't you eliminating it by XORing it out?" And the obvious argument to that is, well, what you just said, well, you know, perhaps some is being eliminated, but there still is a lot there to look at. I don't see that as a real substantive claim. But taking that all aside, here's what I'd like to ask. What's been the follow-up to that? Has Scargill come back? Has he collaborated? Has he retracted any bit on his stance or his position? Or has he just gone away?
He has not retracted anything. In fact, because I kind of present him as a reasonable skeptic, he gets interviewed because I tell, you know, people who are interviewing me from NBC or whatever, they will want to know who can they talk to who's a reasonable skeptic. So I give him Scargill's name.
Right.
So
right.
He appears in one interview saying, after, you know, things have been explained, how it all works and so forth, he says, well, unusual things will happen in random data. And so if you look long enough, you're going to find something unusual. So I get to respond to that in the interview saying, all right, that's true. But what we show in the data and the whole in the experiment is that the likelihood of this particular unusual thing happening is on the order of a 1 in a million or some other large number. So, I mean, it becomes, I guess your point is manifest in what he does in that. Now he's not talking about XOR. He's saying, in implying at least, that we're picking out the unusual bits and saying, see, here's something unusual, which is, of course, not what we do.
Right, and there's even less room for him to stand on that argument of data mining. I mean, I think that's just an outrageous claim for a serious scientist to make. In particular, all you have to do is separate, you know, the a priori events, right? I mean, because as you've pointed out, and I have to say, you know, if someone really takes the time to read your website, there is a tremendous amount of data there. And there's also a very excellent frequently asked questions section that I think addresses every claim that I've ever heard a skeptic make. But do you want to talk a little bit about, you know, prospective events versus retrospective events?
Well, right. We do, as you say, have a well-defined formal analytical series. That is, we have a kind of general hypothesis that is open enough so that we can, we aren't stuck asking, you know, what does this hour look like, or what does this this particular kind of event look like? In other words, it allows us, the general hypothesis says there will be structure in our data corresponding to great events in the world. It's, you know, a little, you can add things like global, or you can say importance to human or whatever, but that's the general notion. And now that's so general that people complain, well, you don't really have a hypothesis to test. But what we do is instantiate that general hypothesis in very specific ones. We are, because of the generality, we can make a test of hypothesis that says this 4-hour period or this 24-hour period will show deviations from expectation because there is a particular event we've identified from maybe ahead of time or from news reports. And that then we can, and we specify furthermore the test, statistical test that will be used. Then we have a completely formal, rigorous test of a very specific hypothesis that's a subclass of the general hypothesis. And we do that repeatedly. We're doing what amounts to a replication experiment, one experiment after another, and we now have 280-some, approaching 300 formal, rigorous experiments, all of which are designed to test this general notion expressed in the overall hypothesis.
There's a couple of points that I just wanted to pull out and kind of clarify, maybe in simpler terms. You know, one thing, this whole idea of there lacking a theory, I mean, I think that's just, it's just ridiculous. I mean, and a couple of things I wanted to point out. One is there is an established theory in physics, a fundamental theory, that there shouldn't be any structure to random data. So if you're doing nothing else other than testing the validity of that theory, that's a pretty fundamental kind of physics thing to do.
Right. And, you're right. There are a couple of implications or results that have nothing to do with this, this so fearsome notion of global consciousness that a lot of people protest. Right. That have to do with really, as you say, fundamental issues in physics, and one could also stretch that to include statistics. We're looking at distributions from true random number generators, that's physical devices, not algorithms, which in when we look at them, in a kind of background way, without reference to anything in the world, then they are beautiful data. They're really good quality random number generators, which produce data that are indistinguishable from what theory, as you say, predicts. But unfortunately for that theory about random numbers, they're not necessarily invulnerable to something happening in the world. And what that something seems to be as a result of not just our global consciousness experiment, but lots of well-done, highly rigorous experiments in laboratories, the random process does not seem to be completely invulnerable to variations from the basic theory,
Great. And let's touch on that for just a minute and delve in there. So the idea is we have this piece of hardware, it's an industrial strength thing that we can hook up, and it generates 200 zeros or one every second, and you add those up, you should always get 100, and sometimes you don't get 100. So that's the basic idea, right? And then the other thing I wanted to really bring up, which is so interesting, is that it's not like this research totally sprung out of the air. It's built on some observations over time that we really can't explain. And that's that if you get a group of people together and they're all meditating, sometimes they cause this same kind of fluctuation in the random generator that we're looking at here. And the same with ritual prayer and some other things. So there is some body of research that we're building off of here. And what you've tried to do then is expand that out and see what the impact or what that looks like if we look at it from this global network of these 65 random number generators spread out across the world.
Oh yeah, that's right. There's actually a prior step. There's laboratory research with just individuals, typically, and sometimes you get a couple of people working together, who are trying intentionally to change the way a random number generator behaves, and they succeed. And it's a tiny, tiny effect, but the experiments have been repeated so much that it's now clear in statistical terms that there is some aberration or a distortion of what's the supposed output of a random number generator based because of human intention or consciousness in the experiments you mentioned with groups of people doing some kind of a ceremony or ritual or listening to a fabulous concert and all just pulled together into a unit, you know. Those experiments, they don't even have intention, but they do have a very special quality of mind, shared consciousness, where people forget about their individual stuff and become part of something that's, I guess you would say, new, a group consciousness. And I think that happens on the global scale sometimes. When 9/11 happened, at first people said, "Oh my God, some poor fellow accidentally drove his Cessna into the Trade Towers." But within minutes, people knew that wasn't so, and became utterly shocked, totally engaged and engrossed, and probably almost, you know, millions and millions of people suddenly were no longer in the world they used to live in. They're not in their individual space, but in something that was connected by this, by the events in New York and Washington that pulled vast proportions of humanity into a kind of unit. And on a day like that, we know that we can make a prediction that engagement, that mutual, that shared state of consciousness is something that may have the power or ability to change the behavior of random systems in a way that's parallel to, even though it's kind of on a bigger scale by far, but it's parallel to what happens when intention is applied in the laboratory or when a beautiful aria brings people to a standing ovation in an opera.
Let's talk for a minute about the 9/11 event as it manifests itself in the Global Consciousness Project. The article I received from Dean Radin said that the variation from the mean on 9/11 was greater than any day in 2001. Is that essentially what you found?
Yeah, it was actually, there are different measures, but the standard measure we typically look at were distorted more than in any day up to that time since the project began in 1998. So it was like, you know, several hundred days, not just a year. And in fact, it's, although we haven't actually tested this in a thorough way, at least in terms of the, scan of the formal experiments we've been looking at, 9/11 still stands out as the most powerful event in the history of the GCP.
Okay, and what about the skeptical argument that you are just data mining that, and that the window of time you're moving back and forth to make it fit? Can you respond a little bit to how you can be sure that that day is really that significant statistically?
Okay, we start with the formal prediction, which it was from, I think, 10 or maybe 20 minutes before the first plane hit and continued for 4 hours after the first plane hit. That was the formal prediction made without knowing what the data actually held, and that shows a significant, it's a significant departure from expectation in the measure that was specified formally. Okay, so that's the starting point. Some people complain, sort of skeptics. One of the friendly skeptics, James Spottiswood, says, or Ed May, "Well, that's not big enough to represent such a fantastic a day in the history of the world." So who knows that, you know? Anyway, that's the formal prediction. Because it was a big event, we naturally feel it's sensible to look at the data and find out what the data look like. So then we open up and look at the whole day instead of just the four-hour period or 4.5 hours. And then that turns out to be striking in a number of ways. For example, the primary measure doesn't just stop at the at the end of the 4-hour period. It goes on. In fact, it goes on being deviant for 2 full days, 50 hours, and then becomes normal again. So then there's another measure, a second kind of statistic that we calculate. That one shows a tremendous excess. It's a variance measure. It shows a tremendous excess that begins actually a little, something like 4 hours before the first plane hit, and it continues to be unusually large for maybe 6 or 7 hours. And then I can't remember exactly how long, but anyway, after all the planes have hit, the buildings have collapsed, everything seems to have stopped in terms of an active terrorist situation. That measure then turns around and becomes very small for the next 8 or 10 hours. So there's a huge spike in the cumulative deviation. It goes up for a long time, and then it comes down for a long time in the middle of that day, 9/11. And then, of course, we look at more days. How about a week? How about a month? And then we ultimately ask the question that you've started with. How about the whole database? Is this spike of extraordinary departure from expectation, is that unique for 9/11? And it is, in fact, in the formal examination, which we can only do by doing it, it mm-hmm. turns out that it is an extraordinary day. And it doesn't, I don't think there's anything at all unscientific about that exploration. It would be stupid not to look. But the formal test is set down before the data are analyzed, and that becomes the contribution to the, the composite overall score that we say represents the test of the general hypothesis, this replication experiment. So, but in other words, these explorations, moving the data around or whatever the skeptics are saying, those are to learn something. They're not to prove something.
That's a very, very good and thorough explanation. And I just want to draw out one point because I think it's particularly interesting and relevant to the discussion I was having with Mr. Dunning there. And that's that 9/11 is a fantastically significant event that we all want to look at and we're all interested in, as are other unexpected tragedies or natural events that might occur. And those are all in one kind of class and events. But as you point out on the website and in the published papers, there's a whole other class of events that we would know beforehand are going to happen. The World Cup is scheduled every 4 years. Every 4 years, it's going to happen. Same with the Olympic opening ceremony. Same with New Year's Eve. So all these criticisms of data mining really have to fall away when we look at events that we can anticipate in advance and schedule the test for, right?
Exactly. And I think on the order of half, it could be more or less, of the events that we have in the formal database of 285 or something are this sort that you can that we know ahead of time will happen. So the predictions are, the formal predictions are laid down, well before the day and the data. And they're, I guess you might say, completely pure test in terms of a prediction without foreknowledge. There's no way anybody is going to change when New Year's happens or, and by the way, the data on the website are fully accessible. It's completely free access to the data. So any skeptic that wants to can, pull down the data for all the New Year's and do the composition across all the time zones and what all, and find his or her own result and match that up with ours. And if he or she wants to look at his, their personal birthday, they're welcome to do that. You want to look at the at what happens when 20 million or 15 million Indians all go to the Ganges and bathe during the Kumbhala, they can do that.
So not only are approximately half the events known in advance, but then from there on, let's just take it forward. everything kind of runs itself. I mean, the statistics, the analytical tools are already in place. It's not like you're fiddling with those after the fact. So once an event is scheduled to happen, it just kind of runs, the analytics run, and the statistical measures kind of run. So this argument that I've heard in the past about that you're not blinded, and there's this somehow this ability to go back and not have metrics in place. Everything's in place, right?
Exactly. It's not that we have, a kind of we don't just turn on the switch when the day starts and let everything run. We have to identify the events that we're going to look at, and that's done. That there is a registry for all that has all the details, the exact second of the beginning of the event and the end of the event, and then in the particular analysis that will be applied, and that registry of hypothesis statements or predictions, if you will, that's available on the web too. So again, anybody who wants to can pull down the data and do his own analysis on the day or the three-hour period or whatever it is that's specified in one of our events.
You know, and it's almost silly to have to go over this stuff repeatedly because it's all is so spelled out so darn clearly on the website. And I have to say, even myself included, I wasn't as familiar with the Global Consciousness Project other than just kind of passing news articles. And the depth on the website is just amazing. You go and you get the answer, and then you get it in another place and another place. And they all kind of cross-reference. So, the last point that I guess I'd bring up on this thing is the whole idea of control, which is another issue you'll hear brought up by skeptics, and that there's a lack of control and we're not looking for alternative explanations for it. And of course, one of the great things about the network that you've built is you have so much data that controls really aren't a problem. I mean, do you want to kind of talk a little bit about how you would see whether there's EMI interference or whether it's just a localized event or all the normal kind of control objections that get raised?
Well, I guess the first and most important kind of thing is to set up control data that don't have events. So basically we have a little over 1% of all of the data, all the seconds of time in the past 10 or 11 years are not in those events that we specify. So that's a huge body that you can look at to find out if there's anything odd or out of the ordinary for random data. And the answer is that the data are random. They match the predictions of probability theory to a T. I mean, of course, there's variance and so forth, but it's exactly the kind of thing that you should expect if you understand empirical probability theory and binomial distributions and whatnot. Okay, so if we want to, we can do what's called resampling, and we do this kind of thing. Some people think of it as simulation or as Monte Carlo or whatever. We take the prediction and say, let's not use the data from the hour and a half or 7 hours that's specified for this event, but instead from a week ago or a month ago or 2 years ago. Okay.
To see if it works, it's kind of
that
control.
Actually used. It's a formal resampling is one of the best ways of doing something like control. Especially when you don't know exactly what the data you're dealing with are like, and that you can kind of, in other words, take your experiment and just move it around in the whole database many times, and what you get is a distribution of the results that come from sampling the database that you have.
Excellent.
Okay?
Excellent.
Yep. Then then you look to see what your real event during. Your real data, the actual hypothesis test, looks like relative to that distribution. And if what you expect or want to see is that your real test is not right in the middle of that distribution, but instead out in the tails, that's what we find.
Well, that's terrific. It really has been an eye-opener for me to dig into this. And I think it's good to really engage the skeptical side of things, even if it doesn't
right.
always...
I really wish there were people like you were saying before. I mean, Jeff Scargo, we've had some who actually did calculations and helped and so forth. And, you know, people, there's a guy named Mike Meyer, my friend and colleague Peter Bancel. Those guys are serious skeptics, but what they did is dive right in. There are more. There's a dozen or so people that actually are part of our, you know, group in a way, who are skeptical at base and say, I can't believe this unless I, you know, do the appropriate tests and so forth. And they work very hard, pull the data, process it through canonical, ordinary procedures and some very sophisticated ones, and they come up with an answer for their own skeptical question. What they've typically found is that the data are real, and there really is something different about the data during these events, which is a kind of confirmation of the general hypothesis that there will be structure in our nominally random data during those moments when very large numbers of people are engaged by events in the world.
Okay, so then what happens? I have to ask, I mean, this is kind of the larger question outside of the Global Consciousness Project, but what happens when people really do encounter and interact with the data?
Well, yeah, Peter is maybe the best example. He's been devoting, you know, half his life for the past 6 or 8 years or something like that. Can't remember exactly when he became interested to more, you know, in-depth analysis of these data. His skepticism is still there, but he long since knows that the data are solid, that the procedures are correct, and so forth. Now his energies are going into finding out things like, well, does distance matter? What is the basic quality of the these outcome measures? He's determined, for example, that what we're really looking at is not some zap to individual random number generators, but correlations among them, which should not exist. They're completely independent devices. They're separated by thousands of miles in some cases, and so they shouldn't be correlated, but they are, just a little bit. And they are correlated just a little bit during these events. Not always, not otherwise, but during these events mm-hmm. they are, and so on. There's second-order measures. There's then correlations among the measures. And these are the kinds of deeper investigations that are necessary for an eventual understanding of how it works, you know, what's really happening.
Right.
So this is...
Right, and this is Peter... This is Peter
Bancel,
who?
Bancel. He's the co-author of some of the recent papers, including one that was published, I guess, last year, in the Journal of Scientific Exploration, which people who are interested in these kinds of things, including the skeptics, should know about. They should read. We should be the JSE, the Journal of Scientific Exploration, is published by the Society for Scientific Exploration. It's a venue for papers and arguments and discussions, like you said before. That's where this... this three-part presentation about the GCP data, including Jeff Scargill's skeptical paper, that's where that discussion was published.
Yeah, we've had Peter Sturrock on the show.
Oh yeah, he's a wonderful man.
I think it was very, very enlightening, and you know, I just pull that out when anyone kind of scoffs at the JSE, which I think is a very, very great publication and very necessary in the, you know, in the overall scene. I mean, yeah. We can't support that kind of peer review of stuff that doesn't fit into scientific orthodoxy. You know, where is it going to come from?
Really. And we have the JSE, I mean, the SSE, which is, of course, published by the Society for Scientific Exploration. That's an expensive proposition to run a serious journal for a small society. So if any of your listeners want to be helpful in the matter of science at the edge, but good science at the edge. Tell them, let them donate some money to SSE.
There you go. There you hear it. You hear it, everyone. Let's respond. And what about Global Consciousness Project? What's in the future for that? And how can people participate and support the Global Consciousness Project?
Well, I have just set up some forums and writing about one of those which has to do with participation. I say, I have to say, I'm not real good at giving people jobs, right? But I love it when people are self-starters and say, I'm interested in this. Can you give me access? And I can do that. I can provide help for people who have a question they're really interested in that relates to the GCP or the data or whatever, to go ahead and maybe even connect them with other people that are also interested. So if people look at the site and say, there is something that really needs to be done, I want to do it, I can help them go for it. My email address is on the site. Let's see, money. Yeah, we actually could do a lot more. There are only two or three of us that do a lot of the work of analysis and so forth. If we had university positions and a bunch of graduate students, we would have some, a really much more powerful array of analyses already in hand. We know good questions that have not yet been answered, and we are working on them. There are only 24 hours, and so if somebody wants to help, it requires skill and also a real interest. We'd be very much interested in that. Or if somebody has vast resources and can donate money, we can then hire research assistants to do things that need to be done and don't get done when we're all just volunteers. That's a long answer to your question.
No, I think it was all well said and appropriate stuff. Dr. Nelson, thanks again so much for joining us.
Thank you for an interesting conversation. I hope that is helpful in giving some of your readers, listeners, a bit more insight into the proponent side of this argument, which always seems so hazy to me on the other side.
There's only one side. One side. If someone comes up with some really valid criticism, I'd love to hear it. But
I would too.
Yeah.
And as I said, and maybe I was too generous, but we really literally do appreciate having people look at it and say, I don't understand this, and I don't believe that, and why. If they don't want to believe it, that's one matter. But if they have a reason why, we'd like to know about it.
Well, thanks again to Dr. Nelson for joining us today. And of course, thanks to Dean Radin for introducing me and for his email exchange. But let me pick up the story from where it goes from here, because it has an interesting, interesting conclusion, very in line with what I've learned through my work on Skeptico. And that is, I decided that I was going to follow up with Brian Dunning then of Skeptoid and tell him what I had learned. So let me read for you the email exchange I had with Brian following my interview with Dr. Roger Nelson. Hi, Brian. I've been following up on our dialogue, had an email exchange with Dean Radin, and a pretty lengthy interview with Roger Nelson. Discuss all the points you raised, as well as Scargill's paper. I know we've discussed whether point-by-point debating is worthwhile, but I really think we need to take another stab at this because your initial criticisms are off the mark, at least based on what I've learned. Give a look at the comments below and let me know if we can revisit this. As we discuss, this is as much about the process of skeptics v. believer debate as it is about the details of the Global Consciousness Project. Then I listed for him the responses that Dean Radin and Roger Nelson had made to his points. And I end the email by saying, I really hope you'll join me for a brief interview so we can tackle these points. It would be nice to deliver some kind of resolution to the skeptic versus believer debate. Here's Brian's response. I'm not interested in discussing their research. That is for people in the field to discuss, and they're already doing that. My interest is helping lay people to understand the difference between a claim that passes scrutiny and has become a part of mainstream science and a claim that has not succeeded in convincing a significant number of researchers. I'm not going around trying to prove that there's nothing to global consciousness. Those are two different points, only one of which is defensible, and that's the only point I'm interested in making. Not exactly sure what that last point means, but nonetheless. And then here is my response. Yeah, but isn't that really what Skeptoid is all about? Help the layperson understand science? Well, you took your best shot at understanding the Global Consciousness Project. Remember, you told me you did quite a bit of research on it. And it looks like you really missed the mark. Again, that's my take. So doesn't this really get to the heart of how we scrutinize science? I can do the show without a follow-up interview, but I think it'd be a lot better if you come back on for a couple minutes and at least give your take. And here's Brian's response. Don't take this the wrong way, because I mean this respectfully. Here's the problem with your show. Because I did an episode where I reported the criticisms that have been made on global consciousness, you would have global consciousness people come on your show and respond to those criticisms. Seems fair. But it's tabloid reporting, because you don't present global consciousness in its proper context. It's a fringe claim that is outside all of established science and has not convinced anyone of its validity. It's not earned the right to be reported. Reporting it as science and presenting discussions on its claims as if it's science is bad science journalism. I believe that participating in such a discussion is counterproductive to the mission of teaching people to think critically. And then this is the final response that I had. Brian, this is quite a claim. I don't think you can back this up. Keep in mind, you're the one who suggested discussing global consciousness. Remember, I gave you a list of topics and you said you didn't know much about them, but you were fairly familiar with the Global Consciousness Project. I had never even read their website until the day before our interview. So now you're saying the science you dedicated a show to and then discussed with me at length no longer has the right to be reported? Boy, I don't think you want to leave things like that. It's an indefensible position. And with that, I closed and I haven't heard anything more from Brian. So it's going to be interesting to see what you, Skeptico listeners, think about this. I've railed in the past about this position of skeptics feeling a need to defend scientific orthodoxy, to be the gatekeepers for all that is good science, all that can be appropriately spoken about or discussed as science. I think that position is absolutely indefensible, especially on the part of Brian Dunning and Skeptoid. I just don't know how he can really expect to defend that position. But that's where we're at. We'll leave it up to you to decide. Let us hear from you. Visit our website at skeptico.com. That's skeptiko.com. Drop me an email. Visit our forums. Get involved there. You'll also find links to all our previous shows, as well as some of the links that I mentioned pertaining to this topic. Well, that's going to do it for today. Thanks for hanging in there for a two-part episode. We have some very interesting shows coming up that I've already recorded, and I'm just waiting to get out. Stay with us for all of that. Take care. And bye for now.